Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome to Who Am I This Time? With me, David Morrissey. Each episode I'm talking to performers from film, television and theatre about one significant role in their career. It might not always be the role they're most famous for, but in each one I'll be trying to find out about their preparation, the excitement and the sense of nostalgia that goes with any key role in an actor's lifetime. Multi-award-winning actor David Thewlis burst onto our screens in Mike Leigh's Naked in 1983, playing Johnny, a homeless, highly intelligent, embittered, rambling street philosopher. Since then, he has been a constantly changing presence on both film and TV, in endlessly diverse projects from the likes of Luc Besson, Ridley Scott, Terrence Malick, the Coen brothers, and Charlie Kaufman. I caught up with him earlier this year to talk about his role as Christopher Edwards in Sky Atlantic's brilliant four-part drama, Landscapers. Welcome to the show. And my guest this week is the wonderful David Thewlis. And we're talking about the Sky HBO miniseries Landscapers, in which he played the character Christopher Edwards. David, it's great that you can join us today.
Lovely to be here. Very excited to spend an hour with you.
And Landscape, honestly, it blew me away because it was such an extraordinary telling of a story. Did you know the case beforehand? Did you know the story it was based on?
No, not at all. Not at all. Surprisingly, because you'd think it would stick in one's memory. I mean, it must have been on the news at the time. I researched it and researched it. But I looked it up when I first got the script and I was amazed that it had passed me by. Maybe I was out of the country or something, but it's such a kind of gothic tale that you think it would have stuck in your head.
So it was a married couple, wasn't it? It was William and Patricia Wycherley, and her parents had been murdered.
That's right.
And they disappeared and they came back, I think it was 15 years later or something?
I think so, yeah. So that's about a time scale. I think the murder was in 1998 and they came back from France and handed themselves in 2015, 13. Yes, 15 years. So 2013 is not so long ago for one's memory to think. If that was in the news, I never noticed it.
But it was a very... Yeah, so there's the straight case, isn't there? You read it, there's the straight case of who they are, what happened to him, what happened to them. But what Ed Sinclair, the writer, does is he really blows that fourth wall away. It's not a conventional storytelling process. What did it look like on the page?
It looked very much like you see the finished thing. Actually, not necessarily the very first draft where Ed had done it all alone, but it was suitably, you know, all that was there, the surreality of it and the breaking of the fourth wall, et cetera, was certainly there. But I think when Will Sharp came on board, he embraced that and took that even further, given Will's past work. And also some of the restrictions, I think, of lockdown made us a little more inventive, creative in terms of what was going to be possible, because we were in full lockdown at the point we made it. It was about this time last year. Mm-hmm. Exactly this time last year.
Because I was going to ask you that, whether the lockdown dictated the look of it or whether it just was a happy accident.
I thought it was more because of the lockdown that we were doing it so sparsely. You know, we shot it in a place called the Drum Sheds in Enfield, called Enfield Studios. I never heard of them. They're not really studios. They in fact hold big raves. They're like three big like aircraft hangars. I don't know what they originally were. And they're totally unsuitable for filming in terms of sound and rain and wind. And it's on an industrial estate out in Enfield, Edmonton. And the first time I went there, I was like, oh, Christ, this is going to be very uncomfortable. It's not at all glamorous. This is just going to be a really tough shoot. And I kind of fell in love with this place. It was really a beautiful, beautiful place by the end because of what went on there, because we were so resourceful. And I'd never seen a production come together in this way. And of course, as you know from the program, you know, the fourth wall is literally broken down.
There's no sort of pretense of saying, here they are in Paris, here they are in this beautiful flat or this dodgy flat or whatever. It's actually, you can see it's a set. And in times they walk off the set and they walk another, they'll walk across the studio, you'll see the crew. Yeah. And then there's some wonderful stuff with that they, because she has an obsession with film. And that's something that they bond over, isn't it? But you know, at the end, it's a Western. It's like High Noon or something. It literally
turns into a Western. Of course, we become cowboys, literally. Which I think that was a late addition, as far as I remember. I think that wasn't in the first draft. I think episode four was largely the trial.
Yeah.
And it suddenly became a little bit procedural. And it's like, after all this wonderful kind of flights of fantasy, we're kind of in a courtroom and we have to be in the courtroom. We have to wrap this up and see how it was concluded. But I believe it was Will's idea to then go, well, listen, we need something to cut away to. Why don't we go the whole way and go embrace the surreality and actually have you now as cowboys? I know it came late, actually, because I remember when I read it, there's two things I've got a phobia about in my career. One is riding on horses and the other is American accents. And I thought this was solid gold safe for that. You know,
it's like, if you're doing Landstingers, then I've swerved that one.
Yeah, exactly. So there's no question about it. And then we got the new draft and I was running my agent going, hang about. I said, there's fucking horses in it now. I'm only on a horse. I'm on a horse with Olivia, a national treasure, on the back, in danger of killing her right around me. And we're all going to, which got cut in the end, but originally we were all going to speak with American accents as well.
Oh, God.
And I was like, oh, Jesus, no, this is terrible. I was like, but would we really? Isn't it funnier if we're still Chris and Susan and the police are still the police? We could do it. I think there's a consensus among the actors. Like, can we not do that?
That's just a step too far. It works brilliantly, I have to say.
Yeah.
Because also there's a whole flashback stuff where, and I've read a quote from you that, you know, you just put on a wig and sort of, you know, they filmed it, the younger you, but physically you change and she changes. Yeah. And there's something really beautiful about the fact that it's like your memory, that you're where you are right now in our story and you're thinking back. There's no attempt to sort of go, you know, this is what happened then. It's your memory of what happened then.
Absolutely.
And it's beautifully done that. It's black and white and very noir, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that was at first, again, when we first read the draft, it was a worry. It's like, well, how are we going to do that? Are we going to do the, you know, the Scorsese Irishman dots on the face, or are we going to have prosthetics, or how are we going to do it? I'm 58 now, you know, and I'm like, I'm playing a 23-year-old or whatever he is at some point. I'm like going, I can't really, honestly.
Yeah,
you know,
but it works.
I look after my skin and I exercise.
So do you moisturize? You know. I can see.
You can see that.
But there is a physicality that you both do. There's a brightness in your eyes and there's a gaucheness to your relationship with each other.
Yeah.
And we as the audience, I think audiences, whether they're becoming more sophisticated or not, doesn't matter, but they're accepting of that. And the way that the tone is in the whole piece, you suddenly just accept that and go, you know, these are the same actors, they're the same age, and they're just now going back into that time in their life. It's beautifully done.
Yeah, and we did that. I think we accepted it and stopped laughing at it. The first time we put all the wigs and the costumes on, obviously it was a bit of a hoot, but, you know, we got serious about it. And I think what I seem to remember what I did was I looked at some things I'd done when I was about that age, playing anything remotely like that character, accent and sort of social background and anything that I, you know, and I found a couple, two or three things where I'm like, oh, right, that could sort of be a version of him. How did I move when I was that age? How did I sound? What was the timbre of my voice and my kind of level of energy and mannerisms. And so that's how I tapped into that, rather than, I don't know how else I would have done it, actually. You know, it wasn't a case of doing something like, remember that, was it Dennis Potter, Blue Remembered Hills, where you had kind of...
They were kids. They had short pants on, and there was something about that. But again, something very endearing about that.
Yeah.
But what at the heart of the piece is this wonderful love story. I mean, you do feel that here are two people who, in this crazy world, have found each other. Mm. And although they've something terrible has happened to them, certainly something very terrible has happened to her, they are holding on to each other in this sort of tempest of a life. They have each other.
Yeah. I think that's the core of it, is really, isn't it? I think we sold it absolutely as a love story before anything else, as a kind of noirish murder thriller, surreal piece of TV. I think it was like, it is a love story from beginning to end, from the very first image to the very last, absolutely classic image. And that's what we hooked on to. It's what Olivia and I concentrated on the most and embraced the most. And I think it's useful. Olivia and I are both quite romantic people ourselves, and are both in sort of very loving, happy marriages. And we both kind of, you know, she adored Ed, who is the writer, of course, of this. You know, she just absolutely adores the man, and I absolutely adore my wife. And I think so, therefore, we had something to hang on to in that we were like going, we know what it is to be that much in love and feel like you would do anything for them, you know, short of it spilling over.
And would you and Olivia, would you sort of, just the two of you, would you sit down and dissect the piece and talk about it and talk about the history of the two of them? Is it something that you would do privately, or would you do that with Will and Ed? Was there much time to sit there and unpack what was there?
No. We didn't, because I don't think that was either of our styles. Olivia is not very kind of, you know, wanting to break things down and to be too analytical. She really likes to just do it. She doesn't even want to do many takes or rehearse or talk about it very much at all. I'm not a big one for lots of rehearsal. I find analysing something useful, depending on the project.
Yeah.
But with this, because the thing is, actually Will Sharp was the one who was very good at doing all that for us in a sense, but also he didn't say an awful lot. And we didn't, I don't know. I think we're both, because there was so much there in the script, and because Olivia had lived with this script for so long because of Ed's writing of it. And I found that I didn't want to analyze it too much because if it's there
on the page and in
well, it
you
was,
have
yeah.
It,
yeah. And also because it was, you know, it is a version. It's our, we're all saying it's very important. This is just our version as the filmmakers' version of this story. And that's why we're breaking the fourth wall. That's why we are appearing as ourselves at times, and why we're admitting this is a TV show. We're not saying this is what happened, because we don't know what happened, because there's what comes out in the trial, which is undoubtedly that these people were guilty, that they did what they did in the way we understand they did it. That was never in doubt. I don't think the evidence is too compelling. At the same time, Christopher and Susan Edwards, in their communications with Ed, the writer, still maintained the story that you see them give at the beginning, that she went up there and the mother shot the father and she shot the mother. And and they stand by it to this day, even though it's really highly, highly implausible. So, and there was a big sense of responsibility as well, in that, is this okay to be doing this? To be taking quite a recent story, very, very recent story, murder story, with real victims, and, you know, quite often having a bit of a giggle as well. Although I found that as we made it, it wasn't as much as a comedy as I thought it was when I first read it.
No, it has, you know, tonally, I think it's perfect. And I just wanted to talk to you about that, because, you know, it has this at times slapsticks, an absurdist sort of tone to it.
Yeah.
But at the heart of it, particularly in the interview scenes with you, I think, when you're with you and Olivia, when you're taken apart, when you're kept separate.
Yeah.
There's a beautiful shot of you in the foreground and her in the background, and she sees you. And, you know, it's obviously a police tactic to keep you apart and sort of tell each other what the other one has been saying. But there's a real love and heartbreaking wash to that, that you really feel that these people have been through hell together and they need each other.
Yeah.
And even though the tone is, as I say, all over the place, that love and need and abuse that these people have been through, particularly her, is at the heart of it. And I thought that was brilliantly done.
Yes, yes. I mean, there was a real care taken, but great intention also to talk more about the abuse that she'd suffered as a child than ever made it into the newspapers or made it to court, because it was acknowledged. It was indeed acknowledged by the judge, but since it was so long ago and unprovable, it wasn't taken into consideration when they were handed out their sentences. And of course, we could not be seen as filmmakers to be going to condone saying, hey, even if you're abused as a child, you can go and kill whoever abused you. That's, you know, a big responsibility there also. But, you know, everyone can watch this and take what they want from it and believe what they want. And we're offering it up as saying, we don't know either, but here's a new and unique way of telling a story like this, a kind of true crime, sometimes procedural piece of television.
I thought it was, honestly, I thought it was a game changer. I really did. I watched it and I thought, wow, we're never going to be able to do do that thing again. And then this happened and then that happened and then they went, you know, we're just not going to be, this is absolutely, the time structure is very interesting because it's all over the place.
Yeah.
Now, do you, when you get a time structure like that, do you just take it as it comes? You know, on the Tuesday we're doing the bits when I'm 17, on the Wednesday we're doing the modern bits, or do you break a script up into a more chronological way? Do you have any way of working through an odd time structure like that?
Well, obviously, it's not usually the case that one needs to do such a thing. I mean, just preliminary, I broke the script down into colours with highlighter pens and so on, just to, so made it easier to read and know where you were at any...
In a time structure.
In
color.
A time. All right. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I do that anyway. I'm a big one for kind of highlighting scripts.
I love a highlighter.
Yeah, and now because I do it all on PDF now, so it's even better because it's got so many more colours, you know. And you don't get the ink smearing if you've got the wrong kind of printer. But then I still print it out on paper, so it's all...
Yeah,
sort of,
I always
and,
work
and,
off
and
paper.
Then I pin it on the wall as well. I love paper. So I mean, as much as you do anything in terms of knowing where you are when you're shooting out of order, as you do with everything more or less. And I probably do have little charts on the wall, to track things, but we were doing it also very quickly. We shot it. I can't remember exactly, but it was quite a quick shoot. And therefore we were, as long as makeup and hair would allow, shooting several things on the same day. And they weren't in fact big makeup changes on the whole. As you can see, there's a thing I actually take off the wig. There was more ideas to use the wigs as hats where we would have some room to room and an AD would actually put a wig on our head like a hat, or we'd drop it from a distance or something. You know, you only see me doing it as the cowboy. It's like, well, listen, when I'm taking the cowboy hat off and taking the gun off, why don't I then take the wig off? This old idea we had of saying they're wigs, obviously they're wigs, but admitting their wigs and the wigs that we need to be able to put on and off quick, like as almost like you do in theatre, really. And of course, there are theatrical elements to it, and it looks like theatre.
I mean, massively. I mean, I thought, you know, it was, I did think, God, you could do this on stage. I mean, obviously cowboy sequence might be a bit different, but I mean, I did think there is something here that we know this is a performance.
Yeah.
And that's what's wonderful about it.
Yeah.
There's an element and throughout your work, I think there's an element of you needing to trust the creatives, that you're part of the creative team, but their vision is something that you step into. And with this, with other work that you've done, you must have to have faith in the people around you in order to sort of create. Do you feel that is something, can you work in isolation or do you have this thing where you've got to be collaborative with people?
I think I really need good directors. I think I can be really quite bad if I don't have a good director. I can make bad decisions myself. And I see that afterwards and think, what the hell did I, you know, why didn't they tell me to stop doing that? Or why did I do this in the first place? But especially with things that are a little more experimental, but I tend to embrace those projects more because that's my own taste, and I think it's just much more interesting. So this, obviously, Landscapers is a wonderful case of that. But, you know, I recently did a thing with Craig Roberts called Eternal Beauty with Sally Hawkins. I did Billy Piper's Rare Beasts.
Yeah.
In terms of, and then, of course, like with Charlie Kaufman, I did Thinking of Ending Things with Charlie, and something like that is so out there that, you know, but you're working with Charlie Kaufman, so you're obviously going to hand yourself over entirely to him and trust that he knows what he's doing, which is unnerving because Charlie doesn't always know what he's doing.
But you've always pushed yourself. You always have. You've never, I mean, honestly, looking through, I mean, I knew it anyway, but looking through your work, your choice of work is always, it's so brilliantly challenging and sort of, you can never pin it down. I mean, where does that come from? Where does that desire to be in that type of work? You know, you're never playing it safe, David, are you?
I don't know. I've never really thought about that, to be honest. I wouldn't know if I would look back at my work now if I'd say that more than about your own work or anyone. I don't know. I'm surprised to hear that.
Well, the stuff that you did, let's talk about Amon and Lisa, for instance, you know, that's a Charlie Kaufman. It's such an amazing piece of work, and it's asking something of you that's very different. It's your voicing. I know you've done a bit of animation voice before. Yeah. It's such a wonderful story. I mean, how does that come about? That must be, when that's delivered to you, are you watching the film or are you just reading the script? Has the film already been made?
The origin of that is very interesting, actually, because firstly, Charlie just called me out of the blue. I never met Charlie. Right. I obviously knew his work, and he was an authentic hero of mine. As a screenwriter, I just, you know, we don't know the names of that many screenwriters out there, but Charlie Kaufman is, you know, if anyone knows a screenwriter, it's Charlie Kaufman. And I was I don't like this expression, I was a huge fan that people say. It sounds like you've got a poster of him on your wall, you know.
He's got a tattoo on you.
You know, that was a great respecter of his work, and I followed all his work, and I knew all his work well and can quote it, you know.
Yeah.
Massive fan.
So did you think it was someone winding you up when you got a call from him?
Yeah. I got the call. It must not have been long after we worked together, actually, because my daughter had just been born. Right. So it'd be, what was that, 2005. And we just taken her to France for the first time. And I remember being by a swimming pool and my phone going and it being a number unrecognized and literally just went, "Hi, this is Charlie Kaufman." "Is that David?" "It's Charlie Kaufman." I was like, "Oh, what is it?" "Charlie Kaufman, the screenwriter." And he's like, "Yeah." And I'm like, "What, really?" He's like, "Yeah." I feel like that. I go, "Oh, fucking hell. Hi, Charlie. How you doing?" And then he goes, he says, you know, Charlie's quite this kind of nervous, kind of quite shy kind of fellow. He wasn't kind of brash Hollywood call, you know. He was kind of probably a bit nervous to talk to me. I don't know, but he sounded anyway. And he says, I've written something for you." So then, not only is Charlie Kaufman calling me, he's telling me he's written something
that
for me,
amazing.
And he'd love me to fly out to New York. And it's a stage, it's a play, and I was like, "Oh, fucking hell, they're doing theatre again." But it's not a play. It's a, it's in fact a what turned out to be like a live radio play. Where I'll jump ahead to what you saw. We rehearsed it in New York, but we did it at UCLA, Royce Hall in Los Angeles with just three nights.
So what, as a radio play?
Yeah. And so what
you
saw, the three of us, it was always just the three of us. And what they'd done, they did this thing called the Theatre of the New Ear, where Charlie had done something with the Coen brothers, where the Coen brothers had written a piece and Charlie had written a piece. And what you see, if you're in the audience that night, is you see one end of the stage, me, behind on a high stool, a lectern with a light on a script. Mm-hmm. And the other end of the stage, Jennifer Jason Leigh, the same, and Tom Noonan next to her. Next to them is Carter Burwell with, I think, a string quartet, or it may have been bigger. It was a several-piece orchestra. Carter Burwell, you know, one of the great film composers of you know, all the Coen Brothers stuff for a start. But center stage in a spotlight, which everyone is actually watching, is the Foley artist, the guy doing the sound effects, doing the doors closing, the clip-clop, the tea pouring, the every sound effect. And he's the physicality. Everyone else has sat down. And he's up and about doing everything. You know, at one point, my character goes for a piss and he's got a little squeezy bottle and
getting in and out of the shower and all
that.
Yeah.
And he did it all. And the audience, that's what the theatre was. You know, we were just almost in shadow. So that was that. And then the second half was it was Meryl Streep, Peter Dinklage, and Hope Davis doing a piece called Hope Leaves the Theatre, which began with them as audience members having just watched An Anomalisa. And me and Jennifer had ran around and got into the audience because we wanted to watch it because we'd not seen it, because that had been rehearsed separately. And then it began, and Meryl and Peter started talking about us. They're going like, oh, I just love that. That was great, wasn't it? That Jennifer Jason Leigh, I could listen to her read the phone book.
And this is scripted. This is something.
Yeah. This is Charlie's written this as well. And I won't even go into where that goes. We'll spend all day. It becomes like a piece of quantum theatre because it's called Hope Leaves the Theatre, which actually meant that Hope Davis, the actress playing a character in the audience, left the theatre because Meryl Streep shouted at her because her mobile phone went off. It's complicated. Yeah.
But this is what I mean about not safe choices. This is like something that you do. It's that thing of just let's jump in and find out what it is later on, sort of stuff.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. And well, that's because of obviously, you know, there's some things you do because it's like, well I'm not going to turn down a chance to work with a hero like Charlie. So I did that. And that was that. It was only about three performances and we all went our separate ways. And then about, 10 years after that, got a call of Charlie. Didn't really see him in the interim, saying, "Hi, it's Charlie. Remember that thing we did?" I'm like, "Of course I do." somebody saw it. Peter Dinklage saying my name on. Anyway, some people were in the audience that night. They run an animation house and they want to do it as a stop frame animation. How do you feel about it? And I think I was in LA at the time. So I said, well, I'm here, Charlie. He says, well, listen, why don't we get together? We've got the old recording. Jennifer's here. Tom's here. And we'll record it for them. We went to the animation house to look at what they had in mind. And that all looked fantastic. And we re-recorded it, the whole thing in about 2 days.
Are you watching what you're doing or you're just doing this straight then?
We're just doing it straight like we did originally.
Right.
But now we're in a radio studio recording it like a voiceover, you know, but mm-hmm. doing it together, which is unusual for animation because animation, you're often not together. You never meet the other actors sometimes, often. But we're doing it together because of the nature of it and we've done it together and, you know, it's quite intimate and Tom Noonan is playing hundreds of characters.
He plays all the other characters, doesn't he? And that's, at first, when you watch it, I thought, well, this is an odd thing because it's the same voice and then it makes sense and it's just such a... There's a moment when you get it.
Yeah.
And when you get it, it's just... I screamed. Because you just went, oh, yes, of course.
Yeah. The faces are the same. If you then look at all the other puppets, the faces have got the same
all
face.
Of them.
Yeah.
But it's just such a weird, unstable sort of world that's created in this... Honestly, I mean, I've seen it a few times, but it's a genius piece of work.
And it's a real syndrome. It's called the Frigoli syndrome.
Wow.
You know, it's the hotel is called the Frigoli.
Yeah, that's
and it's,
right.
And it's where you think everyone in the world is the same person.
It's just...
Which must be awkward sometimes. And of course, then Jennifer Jason Leigh's voice speaks out from this crowd of
yeah,
you know,
the
monotony.
Single voice.
Yeah. So, you know... Things like that just I adore. And it's why I like Charlie Kaufman in the first place, because anything he's ever done is out there in the same way. But, you know, just going back, I love the films of Buñuel. I'm a big fan of surrealistic art. And, you know, that's
what I was trying to get to before about the choices you make in order to sort of, because it stimulates you, it's your world. And, you know, not that you're not playing, you know, the expression, you don't play it safe. What you do is you choose the things that excite you and the things that challenge you and all that. And it comes from what interests you and stimulates you in your own life, what you seek out.
Yeah, I suppose so. And really very much also always never wanting to repeat, never wanting to do something I feel like I've done before. And if I turn things down these days, my usual reason, and it's a sincere reason I give, I go, you know what? I really like this, but I feel like I've done it. Mm-hmm. I've played something very similar to that.
Yeah.
And I don't really want to go there again. And I always like to challenge myself to do something completely, completely different. You know, ultimately, I'm a character actor, and that's what a character actor does, as far as I know. You know, my big inspiration, one of the people who made me want to be an actor, was John Hurt.
Mm.
And that's why I always thought John was, you know,
yeah,
someone who was did so many diverse roles,
yeah,
that, and you totally believed in all of them. And then I was one of my first jobs was with John, very first jobs, you know, I've always kept him in mind. I always thought if I was going to be an actor, I'd love to be an actor like him when, yeah, I was at drama school. And I, you know, I'd like to think in terms of, at least I've achieved that in terms of the diversity of roles I've taken on, because of maybe that's what you're saying. You know, I've always tried to do something different. And of course there are many actors who sort of do something quite similar a lot of the time, and that's, yeah, fine too, you know.
And we find, you know, it's that thing of what we want, you know, so it's yeah, no judgment on anybody's path, but
yeah,
there is something inside that's important to talk about inside what we're discussing at the moment, which is this idea of failure, that sometimes you know, we can be risk averse in choices sometimes. And I think it's important to just talk that, you know, going into a job and experiencing it in its moment is so important. Slightly what happens to it afterwards is sort of none of our business in a way. There's just, yeah, something about the everyday and the people we work with and the creation in that very moment that we have. I know you direct and I know you write as well as a novelist, but there's something as an actor where you go in and you're just there for that, you know, not just there for that day, but that day is everything. Yeah. Do you know what, yeah, I mean?
Yeah.
And there is, and in a way there is no, not that you can't fail, but that failure isn't what you normally think of it is. You know, it's just, you become your own sort of benchmark in a way.
Yeah. Well, I always remember jobs by the time I had making them, obviously you remember the end result, particularly if it's something really good or something really bad, mm-hmm, it stays with you for whatever reasons. But I always think of, you know, the time I had, because that was a real part of your life where many different things happened and you met, you know, it's like you meet a whole bunch of completely new people suddenly in one, yeah, day, and then you're with them for a few weeks or a few months, and get very, yeah, close to them and dislike some people and really fall in love with some people. And then it's all over. And then, yeah, you know, you don't see some of those people ever again,
especially if it's
in other countries,
yeah,
you know, and you have that thing of have a nice life, you know, with some people who have made films in Australia. And I think it's very unlikely I'm going to see you, especially, yeah, years ago where there was no internet and social media, where now you can keep in touch a little bit.
Yeah, that's our profession, though, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's the saddest thing. You see, really, there is a death sad. I get very melancholy towards the end of things, even if I'm not at a very good time. Because, you know, 99% of film crews are lovely, aren't they? I mean, they're,
yeah,
beautiful, beautiful people, because they wouldn't survive in this industry if they weren't great people and great at making a family.
100%. And also, when you've not had a good time, you've all been through it together.
Yeah.
You know, you get to, yeah, the end of a job and it's been a tough job, but you've all been in the, yeah, trenches together and seen, yeah, it all together. And it's, yeah, something that is very bonding.
Yeah.
And talking about that,
that's when it doesn't matter. Yeah, go on.
I was just going to bring up The Island of Dr. Moreau.
Oh, yes.
Which, I mean, you know, it's a fascinating subject around it. I mean, there's obviously recently there was the Val Kilmer documentary that came, yes, out, and there's, yes, another great documentary called Lost Soul, which is about the, yeah, making of it as well.
Yeah.
That was a bit of an experience for you, wasn't it? Well, can you just talk me through how that happened?
Well, that's an understatement. It was one of the most unforgettable 5 months of my entire life. Yeah. And fucking completely awful and completely unforgettable and fantastic and full of memories that I'm so glad happened to me. When I was in the thick of it, at times I felt like I'd really lost my mind and you know, didn't want to carry on. It was just, so therefore it's very hard to summarize all that. I always mean to write something about this. In fact, I've written a sort of 60-page short story about it that I wasn't able to publish at the time, because it used the real names and a lot of quite intimate information about that. And my publisher said, well, can't you change the names? And I was going to change it to like Kyle Vilmer and Brandon Marlowe, I think. But it's obviously what it's about. There you go. That, why do you get involved in something like that? The reason I got involved with that was obviously the carrot of Marlon Brando, the idea of turning down a film with Marlon Brando. But that it how it happened was very sudden, because I remember telling you this on our film. I'd been to the cinema with my girlfriend, and we saw Waterworld with Kevin Costner. And back then, that was the most expensive film ever made. And I remember thinking it was a pile of fucking crap and absolutely just terrible in every way. I just hated it. And so did my girlfriend. We walked back through the park going like, what the hell was that? If that's fucking Hollywood. And by this time, I was getting offered some Hollywood films. It was post-Naked, you know, so... And I was being offered some big studio films. And I remember what stuck to my mind the most was at the very end of the film, as I remember it now, I've never seen it again. I was thinking of watching it again recently, actually. Is Kevin Costner is waving goodbye on a raft to the love interest. Can't remember who the actress was. But because he's half fish, isn't he? He's got gills. Yeah. And so he can't stay with this woman and her child, even though they're in love, and he has to go back to his fishy ways on the raft, and he's waving goodbye. We don't get the feeling he's going to come back. And I remember thinking, well, what? Look, he could come back. He could just sail around the coast, you know, and come ashore. He can breathe on land. He's not a fish. He's not actually a fish. He's not a mermaid. He's a bloke.
I think you're overthinking that one.
Well, this is what we were talking about as we're coming back through the park road. And that's it. That's Hollywood. That's the most expensive film ever made. I'm never going to do any Hollywood film again. I'm going to just concentrate on European cinema. I'm going to direct. I'm going to write. I'm going to do independent sort of, you know, I'm going to be one of those actors who just does the like, cool stuff. And why did I ever do any Hollywood film at all? And I swear, as we got through the doors, the key was in the door, the phone was ringing. And this was, you know, not before answer machines. Anyway, I ran to the phone and picked it up, and it was my agent saying, you've just been offered a... It was nearly midnight. Been offered a film.
You should have known then.
Yeah, yeah. You've just been offered a film. You've just been offered the lead part. This is how you've got told. You've just been offered the lead part in a big, big new movie with Marlon Brando. And I was like, what? Yeah, that's a big lead part. I said, why are you calling me? It's like nearly midnight. He said, because they want an answer now. I said, what do you mean they want an answer now? I'm going to bed. What do you mean? He said, because the one actor has walked off. They fired the original director. The actor who was playing one of the parts has walked off, has had a breakdown or something. We're not quite sure what's happened to him, but he's walked off it. Val Kilmer is going through. Val Kilmer's in it. Marlon Brando. The new director is John Frankenheimer, who did The Manchurian Candidate and Seconds and all kinds of, you know, French Connection too, and just a legend. But you're the first choice. But if you say no, the second choice is definitely going to say yes. But he needs to know now because he's been offered something else, LA time. And I'm like, so, well, can I read? What is the film? He says, it's The Island of Dr. Moreau. Now, I did H.G. Wells for A-level, so I knew what it was. Mm-hmm. And I said, oh, right. I said, I know that story. Hang about. That's like with monsters and stuff, isn't it? That's like kind of cross-cloning animals and people. And he said, yeah, yeah. I said, how are they going to do that? He said, Stan Winston is doing the creature effects. I'm like, well, who's the best in the business? And I was like, this is all sounding very, very good. I said, well, can they get the script to me? I said, well, we can send you a few pages on the fax machine. This is how long ago it was. It was 1994, I think, five. We'll fax a few pages there. All this time, my girlfriend's looking at me going, what's going on? And I think only about 10 minutes before said, I will never work in Hollywood again. Here I am, 10 minutes later going, I might be going to work in Hollywood or, you know, in the Hollywood, in the world of Hollywood. And I was like, they're asking me. And literally I had to get on a plane. This is nearly midnight. I had to get on a plane to Australia for the next 5 months at 8 o'clock that following morning, if I said yes. Mm. And I talked to my girlfriend and I said, well, listen, you know, it's not that long. And I said, it's Marlon Brando. I can't afford to turn down the chance of a leading part with Marlon fucking Brando. I mean, of course, I've got to go for it. But, you know, we'll sort it out. And I got on that plane.
Yeah.
And I mean, to cut a lot, very, 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 very long story short, or it's quite long already. within about 3 weeks, we were shooting the end of the film. The end of the film. If you've ever seen the film, the last image of the film is me on a raft
waving
goodbye off the coast of the island, waving goodbye to the island. Only I'm waving goodbye to a monkey in a Hawaiian shirt and a baseball bat, and Ron Perlman dressed as a goat. And I remember thinking, it's probably the same bloody raft.
It is.
You know, they've probably just got a stockpile of rafts out in Hollywood. And they've got, let's get that raft from Waterworld and put Thewlis on it. I swear to God, a lot happened in between then as well, and for the next 5 months.
We'll be back with more chat after this.
Hi. This is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary. Not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi, you're listening to Who Am I This Time? With me, David Morrissey. Now, back to this week's episode. But what I think is brilliant is what you said at the beginning, which is, you know, it was a nightmare. When you're in it, it's a nightmare. But God, you learn a lot from those nightmares, don't you? I mean, you learn, they're the jobs that you go, wow, I'm learning something here. Even if it is just the lesson of just keep it in the day, there's nothing. And taking, you know, you take your work seriously, but just don't take yourself too seriously inside all that. How can you? I mean, it's madness, wasn't it?
Yeah, I remember thinking I didn't realize that could happen. I'd never seen it happen. I've not really seen it happen since.
No.
But that could happen to a major motion picture with I don't know, I can't remember what the budget was, but it was several million, you know. It was a big movie. And to see and to realize that nobody was in control of it. Yeah. Because since Frankenheimer took it over, who for all he was a legend, I did not end up liking at all. We'll go into that, but it wasn't my favorite human being. And he, I think, was doing it for the tax.
He said in the documentary, says, you know, it was Brando. I mean, everyone.
Everyone's there for Brando.
You've got one of the greatest actors of his generation. He's turned up or not, you know, but he's physically there.
Yeah. And nearly didn't turn up, you know. Yeah. We spent a long time, awful long time. We lost 14 days of shooting just for people not coming out of their trailer.
That is great.
Just for, including me once.
Wow.
By the end, I caught the bad habit. I'm not coming out of my trailer, because they were trying to shoot something so, so ridiculous that even I got like, No.
But did you ever get to the point where you thought, fuck this, as far as the profession was concerned? Did you ever think, I never want to, or did you just think, this is the type of movie I never want to do again? I never want to be in this type of madness again.
Well, yeah, sure. And that was an example of why I thought I didn't want to really work in Hollywood on those big movies, because I'd worked on a couple by then and I hadn't really enjoyed them in the same way I enjoyed stuff back at home, which are much more intimate and with British crews and, you know, the humor and the banter on a lovely British set and the collaboration on the scale of films I was doing before that. And there's not much collaboration on films of that scale. Certainly the ones I'd done up to that point and not. Interestingly, after that, I did a film called 7 Years in Tibet.
Yeah.
With a French director, Jean-Jacques Annaud, and Brad Pitt. And that was actually a wonderful experience. Mm-hmm. We shot it in Argentina and British Columbia, and it was a big traveling circus about mountaineers and the Dalai Lama. Mm-hmm.
Beautiful.
Yeah, that kind of changed my mind, because I did that more or less almost straight after. And then I came back to Britain, and I then did a film out in Belfast called Divorcing Jack.
Yeah.
And had the funniest time. And it's actually also a good film. I must watch
it. It is a good film. It's great. It's film, Divorcing Jack. You got nominated for that, didn't you? I think you did.
I got an Empire Award, for nominated for it.
That's a great film.
I must watch. I keep telling my wife she's going to show it. Yeah. She's never seen it. Because I was like, I always wanted to do comedies as well, and I never get offered many comedies. Mm. It's changed a bit more recently. But back then, I think after Naked, I got seen as this kind of guy who's just like, you play psychopaths or you play... You know, the bad guy, or you play extremely good men, like in 7 Years in Tibet or in Kingdom of Heaven. I play Restoration. I play saintly, very good, kindly,
or good at saintly
men. You know, I do a good saint. I do a saint or a psychopath, basically. In Harry Potter, I'm an extremely lovely, good man in that. Mm. And it's funny how it fell into these two camps. But I loved it. Yeah, just Divorcing Jack, because it was just a great, great, wonderfully written comedy and, great cast and a wonderful director. And I just remember we just laughed and laughed and laughed. We were laughing so much sometimes that we forgot to carry on filming. You know, we just get into all telling stories and they go, hang about, we've got another two shots.
What, three jobs in a row, and they couldn't be more different. You know, and they're asking something completely different out of you on all of those different levels.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's wonderful. The difficulty, I think, is there's your professional life and then there's your private life, isn't there? There's that thing of how you juggle those things and how you sort of, because there is something that we are, you know, we're sort of traveling players in a way, aren't we? You know, I love that sense of, you know, having a pack bag in my, you know, that phone call that you got in New York. I always have, you know, I have a bag pack, which if they need me tomorrow, I'm sort of ready to go, really. You know, and I love that. I really love that. But it is difficult for people around us sometimes, isn't it?
My God, absolutely. I mean, I've suffered that quite a lot. You know, several relationships have suffered for that, and especially I've had relationships with actresses, and that's also because they've got the same thing, and you're all off, and often things break down because you're just not seeing each other. Because if you're both successful and working abroad a lot, it's a really tricky one in terms of your personal life,
And where was this desire born for you about acting? When, I mean, you grew up in Blackpool. I mean, where was the, when did you think, you know what, I might try acting? Where was that for you?
Well, I was telling this to the other day. I think I was telling this to my daughter. It started by mistake, by mishearing something. Because I was at school, I'd never done any acting at all. In fact, I got up for like the nativity when I was like 6 or 7, you know, like that. Right. And I remember going up for a shepherd and me going online going, he truly has been born. They're going, what? I go, he truly is born. I go, what? I go, he truly is born. Now, I go, next. And I thought, I can't say it any louder. And I totally rejected. And maybe the seed was built then. I'll fucking show you. Yeah. But when I was about 15, 16, my friend Cliff, got involved with a drama club at school, and he said, we're doing this play called Old King Cole, which turned out to be a Ken Campbell play. Mm-hmm. And he said, there's a part called The Silver Fiddler. Why don't you, I'm going to be in it, and why don't you be in that? And I thought, that sounds quite cool, that The Silver Fiddler.
Yeah.
I thought it sounded just cool. And I was like, oh yeah, I'll come along and see what's going on in the drama club. Silver Fiddler, I think that's a... Anyway, I got there and it turned out it wasn't the Silver Fiddler, it was Cyril the Fiddler. It turned out to be a bit of a not that good a part, right. and not at all interesting in any way.
You were imagining yourself in a silver suit, the whole thing.
Like, it sounds like a Marvel character, Silver Fiddler. Anyway, I didn't, but I ended up playing not Cyril the Fiddler, but a character called Baron Wad, who so the first time I come on stage, I'm in a kilt and I'm wearing a big Scottish beret that's got a diameter of about 3 foot, and I'm chasing a sausage on the end of a string. And my first line was, "What's that, a sausage, a flying sausage?" Which I did as an impression of Max Wall. Anyone out there knows who Max Wall was?
Yeah, the boy with unruly feet.
Yes, and that's what I was like, a sausage, a flying sausage. And that's the first thing I ever said. And it got a big laugh. And the whole thing went down very well. And then the drama teacher started telling me, like, "You're really good at this, Wheeler," as I was called then. Mm-hmm. And I was like, "Oh, I've not really been told I was really good at something before."
Yeah.
And so I did the next play, which was strangely a musical called Schizophrenia, rather tastelessly. It was the same time as Quadrophenia, and our drama teacher wrote something called Schizophrenia, and it was like in very poor taste.
God.
Anyway, I got the book then, and then went to drama school and auditioned at drama school and got in London and took it from there, you know.
And was leaving drama school, was it an easy progression into the profession? I mean, it seems to me just...
I got quite lucky. Yeah, I did a couple of commercials straight away. So that was kind of, which is funny and it's very strange. Let's not digress onto them. But I made a bit of money, and then I got offered a play, a very good play called Buddy Holly at the Regal. It was a lead part, and it was
a Greenwich.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Oh my God. I couldn't remember that.
That's right.
And then it went a tour around the country. So it was a wonderful theatre experience, lead part, and it was very funny. Big laughs and really just enjoyed every second of it. And then I got picked out from that to do a sitcom called Valentine Park because they'd seen this play. And said, "You're very, very funny, very, very, it's great stuff." But then this Valentine part wasn't written that well.
Right.
And it wasn't that funny. And I was like, "Well, it's all right, I can be funny if the material's funny.
It has to be.
Just be funny."
Yeah.
So then I just ended up doing pratfalls and just doing physical comedy in that because the material wasn't there. But that, that got me kicked off. And I kind of thought that's where I was headed. I thought it was going to be a bit of a, Nicholas Lindhurst type lanky, dopey,
And you were in Only Fools and Horses, weren't
I did,
you?
Yeah, I did an
were
episode.
You in the band, weren't you?
Yes. We got on top of the pops.
Yeah.
So, but that's how I thought, well, that's going to be great. I'm going to be on telly back then,
Yeah, yeah.
It was amazing just to do anything.
So where did it change for you? I mean, obviously Naked was a change, but before then, was it Life is Sweet? Was it changing?
No, it changed with... Paul Greengrass. I did Paul Greengrass's first film called Resurrected.
Yeah.
And that was a massive change for me. It's Paul Greengrass's first film.
It was, yeah.
And he'd come from documentary. And I don't think he'll mind me saying this. He had no idea how to direct.
Well, I did his next one.
Oh, did you?
Yeah, I did. It was called The One That Got Away. It might be 1, 2, 3 down there. It was about Chris Ryan and Andy McNabb and that thing. And
he
obviously worked with a couple of actors by then. So he was, but likewise, I don't think he'd mind saying, he was like learning about actors at that time,
very much.
He had a great feeling for story and a great feel. And obviously now we see where he's gone with that brilliantly.
Well, he's one of the best directors for realism there is now.
Yeah, just 100%.
I mean, fucking amazing what he's done.
Yeah.
But I remember him sitting with me and Rudy Davis, and he was playing my girlfriend in the film, and we ran a scene. And I remember he just said, "Okay, let's go that again. Now that first line, David, just say the first 3 words quite quick and then leave about a 2-second gap and then go up a little bit at the end, pause a little bit and then come down at the end." And he directed it like that for about 3 minutes where we were trying to follow this, until I eventually went, "Paul, do you mind me saying?" He said, "Well," I said, "that's not really how you direct."
Yeah.
And he's like, "Isn't it?" And I said, "Well,
not what really, do I do then?"
"Not really." He said, "I'm really sorry, I've never met an actor before." And I was like, "Oh, that explains a lot." And he said, "What do you do?" I said, "Well, we can sit and talk about it for a while, and talk about who these people are, and then we can, talk about who they, where they come from and how we relate to each other. We can just get to know each other for a start, and then do it, and then try different things and maybe try some improvisation and try and, do all the scene." And then he relaxed and was wonderful. I loved him. And we had a great time making the movie. But it was, and that changed for me because it took me away from TV comedy or TV, whatever I was going
to
be.
It's a brilliant performance as well. I mean, it's a really, it's a difficult film to watch.
It's very difficult, yeah. True
story.
Very
much like a lot of Paul's work. You know, it's essential viewing, but difficult viewing.
Yeah.
But, you know, I watched it. Actually, I watched it about a year ago.
Oh, did you?
Yeah, I thought it was.
It was re-released, wasn't it, quite recently?
Yeah, I thought it was brilliant, actually. And like you, but also with Paul's work, you can see, certainly from Paul's point of view, you can see where he's going and that sort of birth of his sort of technique and stuff like that. I think
And that was all apparent when we got into the filming of it, like shooting the battle scenes or shooting just the stuff at the airport. His documentary instincts kicked in, and then he was the king then. It was like, you don't need to talk about how to do dialogue now. It's like he's throwing that camera around and he's working with real Marines.
And he's writing, and you know,
he's running out onto a real runway and getting at the bottom of a plane to shoot the real people, getting off the plane, even though the people are he's not allowed on the runway, you know.
he knows the world in action taught him a lot.
Yeah, exactly.
But you've directed yourself, haven't you? You've done directing. I mean, what do you, from a director's, as an actor, what do you require from a director? I mean, you've worked with, you know, you've worked with Terrence Malick, the Coen brothers, Alfonso Cuarón, you know, Mike Lee, Ridley Scott. I mean, what is it that you require from them, and what do you try to bring to a set that you're directing on?
I should preempt that with I've only directed two things. I directed a short film called Hello, 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 and I shot that with Kathy Burke and Bob Pugh, based on something I wrote, and that felt very easy. I also had Seamus McGarvey shooting it, who's one of the world's great cinematographers now, one of his early works. So it was very easy, and I knew Kath very well and Bob Pugh, and I didn't have to direct those two. And it all took care of itself, and Seamus helped me shoot and light the whole thing. And it was really very happy with the result, and it got nominated for a BAFTA. And I was like, this is great.
I'm
going to direct. I think I'd already done that before the Dr. Moreau. So I was like, that's also something I can go and do, is making films. I got my first film, I got nominated for a BAFTA. How hard can it be? I then made, in 2001, a feature that I'd written called Cheeky, which I didn't enjoy at all. It's not right. That's not right to say I didn't enjoy it at all. It's really, I really don't like it. I don't think I succeeded at all with it. I had some wonderful people in it, including Eddie Marsan, Ian Hart, Leslie Sharp, Mark Benton, countless people, wonderful, wonderful, wonderful people.
Did the experience mean that you didn't want to do it again?
Yeah. Okay. And I don't think I will. I've been asked quite recently actually to do something, but I just don't think it's me. I didn't grow up wanting to be a director, going like, I will. And I think you have to be a director. Oh, God, you have to be in your blood. Like young Craig, lovely Craig Roberts, you know, who's the, if you don't know him, the actor from Submarine, who's now on his third film. He's just done a film with Mark Rylance. He's like that, you know. He's just, that's his passion, and he's studied every film ever made, and he's studied exactly. And I've never been like that. I've never been that analytical. I have with books, which is why I've written, and with books, because that's more my passion in terms of doing something outside of acting. But I found it far too stressful, really. I just found it a lot of work that I wasn't naturally inclined to. And I wasn't sure I was that good at it. I wasn't sure I was that good at communicating with the actors what I wanted. I'm not very good at thinking fast on my feet. Which with writing a novel, you don't have to be, but you have to make split second decisions making a film. And I don't think that's a strength I have.
And also, you know, with the best will in the world as a director, even though you're, you know, you can be the auteur, but there is a collaborative nature around it, isn't there?
Yeah.
And I think if you're a writer, obviously you have editors and stuff, but you're the creative person right in the center of it, and you're in control of it.
Yeah.
And but as an actor then, what are you looking for a director to give you when you're on a film set? What are you hoping that they bring to you in order for you to be able to create? I mean, that story about Paul Greengrass, when you stop him and say, you know what, I don't think that's how you direct. Yeah. I mean, that takes someone who knows what they're doing to say that sentence a little bit, even though you're quite young.
I was going to say, not necessarily, I didn't have that much experience then, but it was so clearly wrong.
Yeah.
I had and Paul was a very lovely man. I didn't feel, you know, intimidated by him. So that was just a natural, it was a funny moment. I wasn't challenging him. I think it's quite simple. Well, firstly, you have to trust them, directors. And what I always really appreciate is someone who can give a very good, useful note quickly in few words, but it's perfect.
Yeah.
Because you don't want a big conversation sometimes when you're in the middle of it. In between takes, I'm talking, you know, just you've done two takes and it's all right, it's getting there, but you're not quite sure what you're going to do next. And some directors will leave you alone and you'll try and sort it out yourself and you'll try lots of different things. Mm-hmm. And then I don't mind doing lots of takes if you, you know, it's something where you can try lots of things. And I do like to try different things between takes. But someone who can just step in and say just one very simple thing. I remember a good example is Mike Hoffman when I was doing Restoration. And I was doing a scene with Robert Downey Jr. and we were just having an argument. And he just came in and said very simply, at what point does he realise he's lost the argument? And that was it, you know, and that was enough. And they go, yes, absolutely, of course, yeah, right, let's go. Yeah. And we did it. And the next take was significantly different because I had that little seed planted in my head. And some directors can do that brilliantly. Some can't at all. Some are really not. Some quite big people are not great directors for actors. I'm sure you've come across
100%. I mean, you know, I've worked with directors who, you know, you would kill people to go and work for. Yeah. And I would do that again. Yeah. But God, they don't know what actors do. They're not interested in actors at all. You know,
and some of them admit it, you know.
Yeah.
And go, they'll just leave you alone and go, I believe that casting is half the battle. That's a big one they tell you. I've cast you, you do it now. And that's fair enough. It's not wrong.
But also, you know, really big directors who suddenly think, oh, this person's a bully. They just like to shout. And then you have to learn to protect yourself in those and sort of not be intimidated by it because we do want to please, don't we?
Yeah.
And sometimes we have to sort of protect ourselves at this desire to please someone all the time. And make sure that we're being true to our character and ourselves in the process.
Yeah, yeah.
And what about theatre for you? Because I remember seeing you in The Sea, the Edward Bond at the National.
Yeah.
Which is great. Is that a desire for you? Do you have any desire for that?
I do, because I did it again recently after not doing it since The Sea. I mean, the closest thing I'd done was the Anomalisa on stage. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't really theatre, but it was on a stage. I had a dressing room, you know. but straight after doing Landscapers, I went and did, as we started to open up again, Danny Mays and I did Pinter's The Dumb Waiter.
That's right.
Opened up the Old Vic after something like 560 days or however it had been dark for. And it was kind of ideal after all this time. It was a two-hander, it's a one-act play, it's Pinter, and it's the Old Vic. And it was a short rehearsal time, 3 weeks, and it only ran for a week, I think. And it was filmed. It was one of the last things that streamed, you know, we were filming it as well, and it was done for that also. But for the first time, there was an audience also in the theatre. They'd been doing these things at the Old Vic for people at home. I forgot what it's called. It had a name, but you know, basically filming the show, which was a new thing for everyone. It was Jeremy Herron who directed it, and he'd never really shot anything on with a camera before. And it's a kind of skill that's only just been learned, really. And we were rehearsed it in our rehearsal room as a piece of theatre. And then it goes a little strange because when me and Danny got on stage, and we got on stage sooner than one normally would, because as you know, often you don't get on stage until you do the technical rehearsal, which is often like a day before the dress rehearsal, a day before the first, you know, preview, which is, I remember, used to be terrifying. But we had the theatre for about a week before that because we had to work out how it was going to be shot as a live piece of theatre.
So it was a hybrid.
It was a hybrid, and it was a little confusing because suddenly we had to start thinking about the cameras and being directed to think about the cameras. So take a little step back there and turn around. When you do that, can you look over there? And it's like, hang about. This is theatre, mate. Don't tell me to look over there when I do that, because we just get... And when you look at yourself in the mirror, can you tilt the mirror a little bit? I'm like, I can do it now in rehearsal. If you think on the night...
On
mirror,
the night, that's not I'm what gonna I'm going to be thinking there. About.
I've got a big speech here. I'm also doing my tie at the same time. You can sod the mirror. And I never did do the mirror. But it's a wonderful play, and I it really gave me the bug back, and I I'm significantly older now, and you worry your memory is not going to hold up as you get older. You hear horror stories of some older actors, you know, drying. And yeah. Anyway, it wasn't a problem. I've got a good memory for lines. And
did it whet your appetite to come back?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I would really like to do something quite soon again. But it was
what
great
about writing
it was
a play? Is writing a play anything that is? Of
I thought
interest
about
to you?
That. Yeah, I have thought about that recently. Yeah, I don't have any definite plans.
Well, I'm available from
the last
year.
Time I saw you was in the Hangman.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah,
that's
yeah,
right.
It's the last time we actually saw each other. Because I'd not seen you on stage before, and I was a bit jealous of that, because I was like, there you are, I wished I was doing that. I remember seeing you backstage afterwards and thinking, I want people coming to see me backstage.
Yeah, but that was one of those ones that was like it should have come with a bow on it. You know, it was just a gift, it was a fantastic Martin McDonagh piece.
Yeah, well, he's another hero of mine. I must say.
You know,
you
looked at it and you thought every full stop, every sort of comma is there for a reason, and just all I have to do is go for it. Really.
When was the last time you'd done theatre before that?
So before then, God, I don't know, a while. But then after that, I did Julius Caesar at the at the Bridge, and then I did a play at the Royal Court, The End of History, a Jack Thorne play, which I really enjoyed. So I tend to go back and forwards every couple of years to the theatre, and I could do it a lot more if I could afford it.
No, I think that's definitely in my trajectory right now to do that. If I got a phone call this afternoon, it was the right thing, I'd say yes.
Right. Just on that though, just to wrap up a little bit, there's a couple of things that I always touch on a little bit, and one is this idea of nerves. Do you suffer from nerves? Is it something that you feel when you're going into a job? Sometimes, obviously, in the theatre, but in film and television as well.
Not really so much these days, apart from, well, I mean, in theatre, yes. I was nervous when I did The Dumb Waiter again, because I've not done it for so long. But I remember that's all part of it, you know, and that's kind of the kick of it, isn't it? And then you're nervous in those moments just as the music's playing and the lights are going down. That's when you're really, really... But once the lights go up, you're doing it and you haven't got time to be nervous then, because it's like, well, you're doing it. You have to just do, you know, 100% concentration is on that. So if you can bear those few minutes in the wings before you're going on, without throwing up, and I've seen people do that, then it's okay and it's wonderful. And of course, the exhilaration of the end. But I don't really get it with film. I sometimes get nervous before something begins, but that's more about I'm hoping that it's going to be okay in terms of the people I'm working with, I'm going to get on with.
Yeah,
I hope there's no one I'm going to have a problem with for whatever reasons, or someone who's going to really bug me. And I don't know, it rarely happens, but. Because
it does. It's important to say that, isn't it, though? That it does rarely happen. I mean, we hear so many horror stories out there.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, the time, you know, I've been an actor for a long time. The bad experiences I've had with people, I can count on the fingers of one hand. You know, it's so rare. Mostly, like you said at the beginning with landscapers, you know, your cast and your crew, they all want to be there and they all want you to be great. You know, they want to be great, but they want you to be great as well. That's the norm.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
And the other thing is, this is twofold really, but one is about reviews. I mean, do you read reviews? What's your relationship with the critic and the reviewer?
I do. I remember the thing about theatre was thinking that would be one thing that would probably put you off thinking, imagine doing a play and it's like a 6-month run. And it gets reviewed and they go like, yeah, it's all right like that. It could be a lot better if David Thewlis wasn't in it, you know, or whatever. Or you just get a terrible review, basically.
Yeah.
How do you get on stage every night after that? I've got to say, it's never happened, but I've not done that much theatre. So. Yeah. And in The Dumb Waiter, we didn't really have a press night. The press night was more or less the last night because it was such a short run. And it was nicely reviewed anyway. But I was just thinking, well... that would be terrible. That would be awful. And I think I'd find it hard not to read them.
Yeah.
Because I do read reviews and you sort of read them with half a closed eye. And it's dispiriting. But, you know, if it's for a TV or a film, there's nothing you can do at that point.
It's gone.
You know? And I've had plenty of them. you know, I've done this thing of taking chances and always trying to, you know, with your career and doing something new, as I've said.
Yeah.
And as you pointed out, you know, looking to broaden your scope, that can also lead you into some bad situations where you make bad decisions and you do something actually that you're not very good at. Me, for example, doing an American accent, I've done a couple of things where I've done that and it was awful.
But you take risks. You just got to take a risk.
Yeah, you don't know until you tried it.
Nothing got done without taking a risk.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and you know, everybody's a crank with a bad idea until that idea becomes successful. Do you know what I mean? Taking a chance, I think, is always important.
Yeah, yeah.
And the last thing is just about watching yourself. Do you watch yourself, and what's that experience like? Do you learn from that?
Yes, I do. I'm not one of those people who's like, oh, I can't bear watching myself. It doesn't mean I like it or think I'm great, but I think it's just very important, you know, if you're working in TV and film, mainly because in the past I've been disappointed when I've seen, you know, in the early days I'd watch something afterwards and be like, oh, I could have gone further, or I should have pulled back. What I thought I was doing isn't what's coming over on the screen.
Hmm.
And if I could do it now, I would do it differently. So sometimes you get to actually, I think, do that in ADR, you know, when you,
yeah,
people at home replacing the dialogue replacement in a studio afterwards. And sometimes I think that I quite like that because you can change your performance a little.
I think that's a really good thing to say, though, about watching yourself, because sometimes what you think you were doing on the day, you watch it and you go, oh, that thought isn't coming across.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
How is that? Is that to do with the lens they're using? Is it to do with my thought? But what is that?
Yeah.
And I think
physically, I watch myself at the monitor sometimes.
Yeah, I do too. Yeah.
Early on, especially if I'm playing something that's far from me, or it doesn't have to be far from me. You know, if you're playing someone in the military or someone who has a very different body posture to oneself or maybe whatever it may be. And to make sure that what I think I'm doing and what I look in the hotel mirror and see is coming over then on camera, and I think I'm stood super straight and looking fantastic. And then you look in the monitor and you think, no, I need to do that more, because I don't believe that I'm a soldier. I don't believe I'm a policeman, or I don't believe I'm whatever I'm supposed to be.
But also, when I watch the monitor, what's real, and I do that all the time, is I like to see the frame. I like to see the color. I like to see the tone of what the director and the designer and everybody is setting up. Yeah. I like to see, and then think, how do I fit into this picture? How do I put myself and my character in there?
Yeah.
And that's really, it takes me out of the isolation that I feel and the isolation I have. I can see the picture of what the whole thing is happening and myself in there.
Yeah. And I never did that more so actually than on Landscapers.
Yeah.
But for that very reason that you're saying, because how is this looking? It's not straightforward. He's using extraordinary lenses and filters and backdrops and projections. And therefore I need to fit into that, because I can't just method this one, because it's impossible to, you know, I'm aware that I am a sometimes almost cartoon in this frame. And, you know, I mean, there's a strange moment in Landscapers. I'm actually myself. I've never done that before. It's just one shot. I'm not even sure it's clear, but it's just supposed to be me. Because if you look, I've just got I've got the character's costume on, but maybe it's not clear. Maybe there's a difference. but there's a shot. And actually, Olivia didn't want to do that. She didn't want to be Olivia.
I remember that. It's really interesting that you see you as actors.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that's great. But I think there's so much of that going on. It's great to come full circle with Landscapers, because it was, as I said before, it was a groundbreaking piece of work for me. Interestingly, that it was directed by someone who's also an actor.
Yes.
But
yes,
I think there's some, because there's a trust of the actor in it, which is that you can do this.
Yeah.
That you can be brave. You know, I mean, there's something in that he hands it to you.
Yeah.
And I thought it was a wonderful, wonderful piece of work, real game changer.
Yeah.
And at the heart, you know, because it works, because you and Olivia and the other actors, they really invest in the heart and soul of their characters, even with the affectation on top of it.
It's brilliant. And believed in it, believed it was good. I think we knew it was good. It's an arrogant, but I think we thought, this can't really fail, can it? Because it's so well written. And it's so, we knew Will was very, very, he's a very confident young man. very, very confident. But also, it emanates from him.
I think it's one of the things that Khan really felt is that sense of like, people might not like this, but that's not failure. We are delivering what we want to do. I remember when I did Blackpool, I thought people might hate this, but I know what it is and we know what it is.
Yes, yes.
And so if I look at it and think that works, if nobody likes it, that's up to them. That's taste. That's not anything else.
Yeah, absolutely.
And, you know, and I felt that about Landscapes. It had such a surety of purpose and tone. It was brilliant. Yeah. Can I just ask you also about, you know, I know you could just, Shooting Martha, your second book has come out, hasn't it?
Yes.
Yeah. When's is there another one on the way?
It's coming out in paperback in June as well. No, not at the moment. No, I've left it alone for a while. Mainly because I was just working again. But something will click into my head soon. But
Late Hector Kipling, which is your first book, I just thought was brilliant.
Oh, so, great!
Great piece of work. So you have many strings to your bow, and that's just—it's such a great thing to be able to put out there. I love that book, so I must get Shooting Martha in paperback when it comes out. It was so great looking through your work again. It's great to talk to you about it. Thanks very much.
You too, mate. Really lovely to see you. Take care.
Who Am I This Time? Is a Just Voices and Doolally production. Produced by Simon Lenigan, music by Greg Hatlow. Edited and mixed by Russ Keffert at Audio Egg, and presented by me, David Morrissey.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.